Welcome to Passing Years CAM Podcast, Conversations on Error Digestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Dr. Rachel Johnson, having a conversation on AAC and the SLP.
So I want to welcome everyone back to another episode of our Conversations on Area Digestive Management podcast. And I'm here today with Rachel Johnson. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
Rachel is a professor, an associate professor at Old Dominion University in Virginia. And she's joining me today to talk a little bit about AAC or augmentative and alternative communication. And we're going to talk about all kinds of different things related to AAC and a little bit about her research and what things she sees kind of for the future of her research and AAC. So what would you like to add about yourself?
So my research was highly involved with patients in doing a lot of the clinical treatment intervention. And then after COVID hit, there was a bit of a transition and my direction has changed a bit. And now we're really looking at some of the foundational work for treatment protocols and what clinicians are doing, and also how that impacts or has an effect of what the effectiveness looks like on patient population. What I'm really looking at this point is learning and motivation and the factors that are related to those principles, whether it'd be like the healthy adult piece of it, healthy neurologically healthy population, and the factors that are also important for our neurologically impaired population as well. So in really thinking about what is it that we're doing that is driving motivation or supporting motivation, and then what are those components that are within the practice and the feedback that are most powerful or effective in what we are doing. I'm really looking at the factors that are most important for, so what is it that we're doing that is really impactful and is effective?
What do you mean by most impactful?
You know, a lot of our protocols involve us doing a lot of modeling and a lot of prompting and a lot of feedback. And there are some studies that are coming out more recently that are showing that the less that we need to be doing less so that the patients can really get that internal monitor engaged so that they can do it when they're outside of our therapy, our nice safe therapy room. How a lot of us were trained were to do a lot of that modeling and prompting and continue doing that, but it never transitions outside of our therapy room. And so those are the factors that I'm really interested in looking at to identify how do clinicians identify when to, you know, kind of stop doing that, when to back off. And then what do patients really need to take those strategies that they learned with us outside of our environment to actually put it into place in the environment, in their natural settings, right? Who they're working with, wherever, whether it's the grocery store, their family, or nurses, doctors, those pieces. So okay. It's still like the AAC part of it, but it's more of how can we help them use those strategies and how can we equip clinicians to teach the patients how to use those strategies most effectively?
I think that's actually a big missing hole in what we do, you know, is how to actually put the strategy, how to implement the strategies once you're outside of the clinical setting. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that could be a big area. Well, it is a big area, I should say.
Yeah.
It could be, but is. For people who are listening, I want to start, one thing I like to do, Rachel, is kind of start at the beginning. So can you just define AAC? Like, what is it and what does it cover?
Sure. So AAC is really any aided or unaided strategies that an individual might use either permanently or temporarily to help them to get their communicative message across. And so this can really vary. You know, our hand gestures, our facial expressions would be considered part of our unaided strategies or that we use. And then, you know, I think a lot of us can relate to or think about automatically when we hear AAC is the technology piece, that high-tech device that kind of appears to be external to us, but is really a very powerful tool for individuals who aren't able to use their natural voice to communicate.
Can you add in a little bit about, because I'm thinking about people who don't work in the area of AAC, the difference between like light tech and high tech options for AAC and kind of what you might see with a patient?
So the light tech or the low tech could be like a picture board that they might point to, and the pictures might be letters. They could be actual photos of objects or people that are important in their lives. It could also be the, you know, memes. It could be anything, really. And then there's some devices which would be considered your mid tech, where you would have those same types of symbols of some sort, but there's might be a recording that goes along with it. And then our high tech devices might have options to have like the generated, the computer generated voice that accompanies any of those messages. And then there's usually a dynamic display part where they push a button and then it changes to a different page, or it does some action, which could be speaking. It could speak and go to a different page. And then there's also, we might consider how they might access all of those systems as well. So their mobility would be another contributing factor for whether they might use the lower tech, the high tech or mid tech type of systems.
If you've got an SLP who's wanting to get into augmentative and alternative communication, wanting to start having that maybe a little bit more accessible or using it a little bit more in their practice, do you have any hints for where they could start, like where for competencies or for, you know, what kind of knowledge and skill sets do they need to work in it?
So hopefully they have, they've had some experience or some maybe exposure to it at some point, but even if they had not, a lot of programs in clinical education in the university realm, they didn't actually have any dedicated coursework required until 2014. So there's a lot of clinicians who are working who may not have had any of that experience. RERC, which is the Rehabilitation Engineering Research Center, they have a wealth of information available on their website. Penn State, Pennsylvania State University, they have a very robust AAC program, and they actually have some, they created this web center that's called AAC Learning Center Moodle, and it's free and accessible by anyone. So as a clinician who be a little uncertain about what it entails and feel that it's very daunting task to endure, that would be like my first and foremost place that I would recommend to go and get your feet wet and start to learn a little bit about it. And then from there, even within the information that you're learning, there are a lot of resources where you can then explore a little bit more and learn a little bit more as you're going through.
I was not aware of that site. Yeah. And do you mind just sharing one more? You said it's Penn State University.
Yeah. And it's, so if you Google AAC program at Penn State University, they're connected with, or they are the housing unit with the Rehabilitation Engineering Research Center, or RERC. So you'll kind of find them one in the same, and they kind of link into each other. But through there, there's just a wealth of information and resources for advancing your knowledge. There's a lot of webcasts that you can listen to. There's the actual learning center, which will give you different webcasts, and it's set up so that, you know, it's for professionals, but it's also for universities to use with students. So students can utilize that as well as part of their training, their pre-service training. But it's definitely at a level for professionals as well to utilize and even expand their knowledge from what they may have experience already in. Because AAC, it doesn't stay, you know, stagnant. You know, it is constantly changing and evolving and growing. And there's always something new coming out or something new to learn that might be really applicable to, you know, the patients that you're working with.
Well, I noticed, because it was quite a long time ago that I got to work a little bit with AAC, and the technology is so far advanced now. And the even then the devices in the same device, like where I looked at a Dynavox 20 years ago and where Dynavox is today, it's a whole new world. So
yeah, it is.
You've been working in the field and looking at AAC for a while. Do you mind sharing a little bit about what you've found in your research and kind of what some of the areas are that you've, you know, looked into?
Yeah, so a lot of what I've looked at with AAC is the pre-service training piece of it. And then most recently, we were looking at professionals' knowledge and use, and even the barriers that they identify in providing AAC services in the workplace. And we also, we did this really big survey, and we were also looking at what their preferences were for professional development. We did some correlational work because we had such a great, robust survey where we were also looking at some correlations. So are there any predicting factors that might help us to kind of push our efforts into a little bit more directly? And the one of the biggest pushes from 2014, at least on Asha's standpoint, was to, you know, have the pre-service training include some dedicated AAC coursework. And so we identified, or most recently was, you know, identified most programs are doing it. They've really met that standard, and they're including that within the pre-service training coursework. And so the clinicians, what we found, I thought was very interesting, that the knowledge for pre-service training isn't about the coursework. It's important, you know, the classes are really important, but what really is driving that knowledge place is the hands-on clinical practicum experiences, which is still really lacking in our curriculums based on the information that was provided from the university programs that responded to our survey, at least, which, you know, I think it just speaks to how important that mentoring is, and really ensuring that, you know, we are all inclusive when it comes to that, the AAC training component. And then we were also looking at the use. So we really were interested in, okay, does that knowledge actually translate into actually using it? We identified no. You know, even if you have that hands-on clinical experience and the pre-service education, the driving force for that use of AAC is related to the continuing education. So clinicians actually engaged in that continuing education that was had AAC, something involving AAC, they were the ones that were most likely to be using it in clinical practice.
Which, oh, that's interesting.
It is interesting. So professional development plays a huge role in what we're actually doing. So, you know, really making sure that what is out there is evidence-based so that clinicians can actually be implementing best practices, but even thinking about how are we getting the evidence base so that it is something that clinicians can implement, because there could be, you know, barriers within that component as well.
Well, and you mentioned in part of your survey, you also looked at barriers to AAC. What were some of the more common barriers that people identified?
Caseload, of course, right? So the more patients, the more likely they were to identify caseload as a barrier. But very interestingly, if they had hands-on clinical experience, they were less likely to identify caseload as a barrier. Right. So
interesting. Yeah.
There's a lot to be said, you know, about that circle, right? So that hands-on experience, that, you know, are they better able to know the expectations and how to manage it because they had some mentoring and got to see it in practice versus having it, you know, having to do it and not having that mentoring? That could be a component of it. It's definitely something to look into a little bit deeper. We also found some geographical regions were more likely to have resource and support barriers than other areas. So definitely something related to advocacy within maybe the supports that are offered within their state location. Maybe they don't have access to it, or they don't know where to go to in order to get access to those products or support or resources just in general to do what they need to do for their patients.
That's actually something I've heard from clinicians recently, is that question of, well, where do I even go? Like within their state, they're not sure, you know, who has the information that they need, or, I mean, or has devices that they may be able to look at or get a loan for, you know, get a loaner to try with a patient, that type of thing. There seems to be a lack of knowledge of the resources. Is there a source that you know of that gives those state resources, or, you know, lists them anywhere, or anything people could look at?
So, I mean, it really does vary by region. And it also varies by population within regions. And then by, you know, there are certain representatives for different devices that are commercially available, and they cover certain regions, and, you know, getting access to them is always an option, but you're going to get a little bit of a bias within whichever, you know, commercial company you're going to reach out to. Every state is a little bit different as far as like what they have accessible within their region. Pennsylvania has on their website, so their state program offers continuing education that is free, and it's available online. And those modules are really, really helpful, but then it doesn't necessarily link to, okay, who do I contact within my region, right? If I'm living in California or, you know, in Maine, for example. So I think there isn't a central hub for the regional components that I'm aware of anyway. I think a lot of it is Google searching within your area to see what is accessible and available.
I just wondered if there had been anything put together. And unfortunately, you said what I hear for a lot of things, which is also varies state to state, region to region.
Yeah.
And so that's going to impact what people can access or what information they may have available to them.
Yeah.
So that's still be good to be aware of, though.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is, you know, if you can at least even get a direction of, you might have to do like your own resource list, which may be reaching out to the different commercial companies and identifying, so who is covered in my region and what is their contact information? And then, you know, having those individuals, you know, contacting them and asking them, how do I get access to this? And I think that once you do that, you find out that, oh, this is a community, right? And they're all going to they all are there to help the patient and to help you get what the patient needs to be successful. So it really is just a matter of reaching out. I think time, right, is a big component of that. So the productivity demands, a lot of this is going to come if you're not someone who does it frequently. You're doing that legwork on the initially to get it going is going to take you longer than someone who's already been doing it. And so there's a lot of advocacy too within the within wherever your work setting is to allow that time to do that legwork to get at least that starting point so you can provide those services.
So in looking at the barriers, one that I've heard a lot for especially the high tech, is the cost. Mm-hmm. Was that identified in your research? Did that come up at all?
So no. primarily, you know, the cost of it is going to be insurance dependent. Mm-hmm. And so that is, even at this point, is going to depend on the underwriting of everyone's insurance plan, because it isn't even that, oh, they have this insurance company and they tend to not fund it. It's really, oh, their underwriting with this policy allows or doesn't allow. So I think the one thing I can provide that may be reassuring is that whatever system you identify to be beneficial, most, you know, a good match for your client, that the commercial company will help you to identify what is covered and what isn't covered under that patient's insurance plan that is in place at that time.
Okay. Well, I think a comment you just made kind of a lead into the next section of what I wanted to talk about, because you said depending on your client's needs. Mm-hmm. So do you mind sharing a little bit about some of the areas, like if I were walking into my patient for the first time, and I think that they may need AAC, or I've been told they need AAC. Let's say that we already kind of have that going, you know, that thought going, mm-hmm. what areas do I want to include in my assessment? You know, what do I want to look at with that patient to help decide what direction to go with the AAC? Do you have any particular areas you'd recommend or?
It really is going through everything that you would go through with your typical assessment. So you're going to look at your hearing, your vision, your mobility, their literacy, their language, all of what is their diagnosis? Is it rehabilitative? Is it progressive? You're going to do really a lot of the same things that you do for your regular evaluations, but you're going to identify what strategies are helpful for them to be successful. And so is it successful for them to have written text? Is it successful? Do they have better success when they have visual supports? Do they benefit from having auditory output or somebody modeling it for them first? And then can they do it after they've seen it? All of those are things we do in our everyday clinical setting. And it's just really identifying, okay, can I teach them to do this without me there so that they can be that system can support them in their communication instead of me or their loved one.
Well, you mentioned that your future research, you're kind of moving into looking more at strategies and how to implement them outside of the clinical setting. So can we review a little bit? You just mentioned some strategies. Like what are some of the key strategies that people typically either do use or should look at, you know, to assess with their patient or their client? And then we can talk, you know, after discharge, like in the home setting and all, but let's kind of make a list if we can of the different strategies of, you know, like some key ones that you say, always look at, you know, these strategies, you know, assess them. Mm-hmm. Do you have a list like that?
I think it's really what do they want to do, right? So what are their goals? Where do they want to communicate? What environment do they want to communicate in? And what is it that they want to communicate? Ensuring that they have access to that vocabulary to do so. One of the biggest barriers, if you've ever had to use any type of a communication device that was created by somebody else to communicate something you wanted to communicate, you quickly realize that access to vocabulary is by far the most important aspect of it. And so that's access to, you know, can they physically get access to it, which I think we can figure that out. There's no system that we can't, you know, modify to ensure that they physically have access to it. But one of the biggest challenges is the vocabulary. There's a lot of cognitive effort that has to come, that gets involved when you're having to identify a different way to communicate what it is you want to say. So taking the extra measures, I think, in identifying who they want to communicate, where they want to communicate, what is it that they typically would communicate or would like to communicate within any environment or whatever it is that they're desiring to communicate, and ensuring that they have access to that vocabulary is really key.
Hey, you just said something I found very profound that I've never thought of in all of my years of practice. And I'm rewording it, I'm paraphrasing it, but you said the cognitive effort that it takes to change their communication style and strategies that they use. And I've never really thought, and I know I just kind of butchered what you said, but what I took away from that was that, and I'd never thought about it before, you know, you see a patient and they have a disorder and you're working with that disorder, but I've never really thought about the additional cognitive effort, the cognitive load that is on them to shift to a completely different style of communication or, in a way of getting their message across, like them having, I have thought that they have to learn a new method, but I hadn't really thought about the cognitive load that places on them to learn to use an AAC device or communication board, something even simple, you know, like what we think of as a simple communication board. That's still going to be a completely different way of communicating. And that's going to put a different cognitive load and really could impact that mm-hmm. patient's overall kind of function and recovery and how they use it and there's a lot of implications there when you think about the cognitive load.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, if you just think of, if you wanted to say, you know, share with somebody your dog's name, but you don't have access to the vocabulary, do you just give up, or do you like try to come up with different ways to, you know, try to get them to at least guess it, right? And that takes a lot. It takes a lot of, you know, it slows down the communication, but it also takes a lot of effort on the communicator to identify, okay, how can I do this? What is a way that I can help them to, you know, get it? It's like playing charades on a whole different level.
Yeah. I like that analogy. Well, I know we've talked, and I say we've talked about it. I mean, the profession has talked about in general with AAC that, you know, if a patient's able to spell and you can give them the alphabet, then you have that unlimited potential access as far as vocabulary. Maybe it's a little slower, but now with word prediction and different things, that, you know, that can be really functional. But if you've got a patient where they're not able to spell and you're having to select their vocabulary, select the icons that they can point to, or select the words that they have access to, it would be very key to know what their goals are and what their main needs are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's the individualized component of what we do, right? So making sure that system is personalized to them and has on there what is important to them and works for them. A way that, you know, I might have my system structured is likely going to be very different than how you might have it structured based on how I would communicate or what, you know, how I kind of think of organizing, you know, the content within that. So I think spending time to really think about that and, you know, doing it together can really make a big difference rather than doing it for them. Right.
One thing that used to bother me that I would see in the hospital, and it, what you're sharing kind of emphasizes the negative reaction I had to it. We tend to make in acute care, we have our kind of like set communication boards, you know, two or three or four of them or whatever that we give patients to use versus personalizing them in any way. And one of my pet peeves was when it would have like food and drink selections on it, but then you give it to a patient who's not allowed to have food and drink, you know, that type of thing. So even going that simple, you know, making sure what you're providing that patient fits them the best. So they're not sitting there with, you know, I mean, I could see if you could, you know, you're not allowed to have anything to eat and drink, but you're constantly pointing to that for the nurses.
Well, it's important to have access to the vocabulary to let them know, hey, I'm interested in having this.
I want these, but it is, but I guess it could also maybe increase the frustration, you know, if you're getting told no all the time, but
you know, the other piece of it is, you know, not restricting them either. Right.
So oh, that's true.
You know, there's lots of, you know, discussions about, do we have curse words on, you know, children who have access to AAC, do they have access to curse words and words to talk about sex? And, you know, those are all, you know, discussions that are being had, and those are very personal discussions and, you know, ones that, I mean, we all have access to that vocabulary, but we learn when is appropriate and when it is not appropriate to use that, that vocabulary. So I, you know, it goes along the same way with persons who are using that system to, as a primary means of communication. You know, having access to that vocabulary is important because if they want to curse, then, you know, well, is it the appropriate place to do it? And learning that it is or isn't, right? So that's all part of our life lessons.
I'm so glad I got this opportunity to talk with you on the podcast because you've opened my eyes to several points, and I've been around for a while. And I did a small amount, very small amount with AAC back in graduate school and shortly after. And one thing you just said, because I said that about, I thought it was frustrating to have, I want something to eat or drink on the communication board. And I thought that was bad to have it on there. And you just pointed out that really I may be restricting the patient more than they should be restricted because they should have access. I mean, if they want to eat and drink, they should be able to say they want to eat and drink, even if they're not able to for medical reasons. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we should make that choice to restrict their vocabulary and restrict what they have access to speak or to share if they've got certain, because that may be a way of them sharing their frustration and what their goal is. You know, their goal is to eat and drink. And if we don't give them access to say that, they can't share that information. Mm-hmm. So that's a different perspective. That's a new, different way for me to look at that. And I appreciate that because I hadn't caught that. And then, like you just said, children with curse words and how to talk about sex and different topics that, you know, people need to have access to.
So, oh, and then I can share one other part that we did identify. So we asked also about professional development and preferences for getting access to that professional development and how do they want it? What do they want the topics to be? And, the, you know, just kind of getting a general idea of what would be helpful, considering, you know, how important continuing education is for the actual implementation of AAC into clinical service. And it really depends on the work setting is what it really boiled down to, at least from the factors that we looked at. And they weren't by any stretch all inclusive. So there may be factors that are really predictive for that. But of the ones that we were really looking at and honing in on, it really had to do with what medical setting they were in, what topics they really preferred, medical setting. Those clinicians had a preference for topics about AAC modalities. So how to assess access and also train that. And then they really didn't want that distributed, you know, type of continuing education. They least liked that one, not that they prefer MAST or any of the other modalities we asked about, but they really, they least liked the distributed, you know, clinicians who are working in private practice. They actually liked having written type of continuing education, which I thought was really interesting. So it's not necessarily anything that's terribly new, but it is something that is confirmed in that, you know, the targeted audience and where they're working has a lot of influence on what their preferences are for a continuing education.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about written. I mean, I know we can get continuing education for written materials, but I hadn't thought of that as being a preference.
Yeah.
In education, yeah. But yeah. Well, Rachel, I want to thank you for your time today and talking with me about AAC. And I think it's a good starting point. You covered a lot of really good points. As I said, I got two wow moments, you know, kind of changed my thinking on a couple of things. So hopefully others, as they listen, will have some takeaways, but I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.